I was raised on land stolen from the Squamish people that is now the home of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Snoqualmie, Tulalip, Sauk Seattle, Suquamish, and Stillaguamish people. This podcast is being recorded on land stolen from the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people nations. I am a settler here and continue to trespass on land that my ancestors colonized. This podcast is in support of land back and our Indigenous and Indigiqueer comrades. We are continuing to ensure justice and repatriation today in every way that we can.
It's true. God's an astronaut. Ours is over the rainbow. In between is where the monsters live.
Your favorite scary movie? Have you ever thought there was something a little bit, well, queer about it? Welcome to the place where every night is movie night. Join me, the non-binary skeleton in your closet.
And me, the transgender creature lurking under your bed.
As we raid the Crypt Keeper's DVD collection to show you the queerness behind your favorite genre. Hi, I'm Stephen King.
And I'm MacReady. Are you sitting uncomfortably?
Perfect. Let us take you to the place where the monsters live. Welcome, wicked stepmommies. Stepmommies. Chattering sex demons and puzzle boxes to this episode of Where the Monsters Live. I'm your host, Stephen Kink, and my pronouns are they, them.
My name is MacReady. I'm your co-host. My pronouns are he, him.
Fabulous. All right. Our discussion today will contain spoilers for Clive Barker's 1987 film, Hellraiser. Couple of trigger warnings here. There's extreme body mutilation, BDSM, animal cruelty, creepy misogynistic uncles, attempted incest, sex and goop, not necessarily together, but also together. forewarn all those who listen here. MacReady, is there anything I miss?
Some crazy stop motion stuff.
Hey, Mac.
Hey, Steven.
I have such sights to show you.
Are you ready to talk about Hellraiser, Mac?
I'm ready to see some shit.
Yeah,
I'm ready to be
go.
Shown some shit.
Oh! All right. Okay, so we're going to begin by talking about our individual origins with this movie.
Shall we begin like David Copperfield? I am born. I grew up. Or shall we begin when I was born to darkness, as I call it?
So I watched this for the first, having no knowledge whatsoever of Clive Barker. I made my roommate do it with me. We're still friends now, so that says something. it was fun. I thought it was like a slasher or something. That's kind of the impression that you get from a lot of kind of the slasher lineups that include Pinhead, which drives me insane. Is not a slasher. It's a weird gothic sex demon.
Yeah.
This is not the same genre of movie. Stop it. Stop it, whoever's doing that. Do your research. It makes me insane. I watched the movie and I was like, what was that? I must know everything now. I went in, I watched all 11 of them. I've read a lot of Clive Barker's work now and it makes sense. Yeah, I've watched it 4 times over the last couple of weeks for this podcast. My Blu-ray has 3 commentaries, so I said okay,
that makes sense.
So I've watched it 4 times, and the fact that I don't hate it now is a testament to how amazing this movie is. The more I watch it, the more it just absolutely burrows under my skin, pun completely intended. Yeah, I'm very, very pleased with the Blu-ray that I have as well. I have the Tetralogy from Arrow. So that's the first 4 movies. If you're going to get the box set, get the first 4. Don't get the older ones that skip the 4th one and go to 5, because 5 is the worst one and 4 is a lot of fun. we'll do the rest of the series. MacReady, we will do them. You will watch them with me and it will be fun. Most of them are bad, but that's the fun of it. Clive Barker and his work is very, very special to me, both as a writer and a fan and a queer person with a complicated relationship to my body. This movie's very special, and there's a lot of reasons that we decided to start with it. We'll get into it in a sec.
It's a
Last
good
but not
Valentine's
least.
Day movie, I think.
You
We're
know,
recording this on Valentine's Day.
I didn't say we are recording this on Valentine's Day. It's a great, great Valentine's Day movie.
Shout out to all the Valentines out
Shout
there.
out to all of you people with partners out there. We love you. Mac and I are recording this single as a Pringle today. And honestly, I would not rather not be spending my Valentine's Day any other way.
Absolutely, me too. My origins with the film, I could not tell you. I know that I watched it a year or two ago. Unfortunately, my memory is just very bad. I think it's because I'm getting old or something. I was in the club that Steven
He was in the
started
club.
back at our old university. But I don't think that that was the first time that I watched the film. I believe the first time I watched it, I was with a friend who, like, we watch a lot of horror movies together. So I think statistically, it's more likely that I first saw it with them. And then I watched it for a second time at the club, many years ago. And now
The club.
at the club,
Club.
and
What is
now
it about?
I rewatched it very recently, about a little less than a week ago. I was over at my friend's apartment and I showed it to her for the first time. So I actually kind of got to see, a first-time reaction to the movie. She had a very similar response to what you said. She was a little disappointed that there wasn't more Pinhead because she thought that, it was a slasher. She thought that Pinhead was the main antagonist, but no, he's not
No,
really. He's in the
he's
movie for
not.
about 10 minutes. He's more of a, like, force of nature. He's like a hurricane that comes in and
And
wrecks
he makes a
everything.
10-course meal out of those 10 minutes. I mean,
He is. No, he certainly is. He's serving cunt the whole time, but he's definitely not as big of a, well, okay, he's a big threat, but he's not as big of a tangible threat as Frank, I would say, which we'll talk about more.
We'll talk about our friend
Yeah.
Frank.
My relationship to the film, I have seen a lot of the, I guess, quote unquote, classic horror movies. And this one is not my favorite. It's not my least favorite. I think in some ways I actually prefer the second one more than the first one, which
I
might be
completely
a hot
agree.
take.
No, I mean,
I don't know,
it's not a hot take for
but it's
me
not bad by
because
any means. I think it just wasn't what I was expecting when I first watched it.
I think that the first one is a better made movie overall. I think like everything flows together a bit better in the first one, just like, plot and character wise. But I personally enjoy watching the second one a lot more, which
Yeah,
we'll
I'm
get
glad you
to
said that.
that. I love it so much. So we have a specific story about this movie, for the two of us regarding some fan fiction.
That's
You forget about the fan
you want to
fiction.
tell or should I?
I can tell it.
Go
Why don't
for
we
it.
tell it together?
Okay.
MacReady and I, as well as being part of the Scream Queens together, we started a writing club with the two of us and a couple of Mac's friends, where we would all like write a short story based on a prompt every week, and then we'd get together and discuss. It was very fun. It was lovely. And for like one of our last meetings, when we were all just hanging out, we were like, we're tired. We want to do a goof one or just have fun with it. And we all got assigned different members of the club, and we wrote fan fiction about them. I was assigned MacReady, and I wrote a fanfic about Mac meeting the Cenobites, but because Mac is asexual and not interested in the pleasure and pain side of things, it was just Pinhead and the Chatterer giving Mac a tour of hell.
Yeah. Oh, it was so good. I still have it. I actually, I printed it out. I have it.
Good. I'm so glad. I'm so glad you still have that.
The
You know, maybe down the
Chatterer to
line.
this day is probably one of the best characters in horror movie history. He doesn't need any lines. He's just a
No,
very powerful
he's just
on-screen
chattering.
presence. He's chattering away. He knows what he's
He's
about.
chattering away. You know, you can't shut him up.
You can't shut him up.
Yeah. You know, maybe down the line, when we eventually do bonus material, we can do dramatic reading of
That would be great.
the Mac Hellraiser fanfic. Yeah, I had so much fun writing that. And yeah, that's another reason I wanted to start with this one for us, because we have lore about it. We're gonna place this film in history in its time and place.
Don't you blame the movies! Movies don't create psychos! Movies make psychos more creative!
Placing the film in time. So yeah, you thought this was just a big scary movie podcast? No, we're learning things. We're gonna learn things today. Mac, are you ready to learn?
I'm so ready to learn.
I'm
Teach
so ready
me.
to learn. I'm gonna teach you. Okay, so this film came out in 1987, which is my personal favorite year for horror. We'll do many movies from 1987. It's the best year. Just looking at what came out this year, but again, I'll get into that later. So this film was made in Thatcher's England. Oh yes, she was re-elected this year, making her the longest continuously serving prime minister in England since the 1800s. Boo. Thatcher released a statement this year. Yeah, if you were curious about her positions on homosexuality, spoilers, not good.
Not good.
For people who are unfamiliar with Thatcher, she was essentially kind of, to oversimplify it a bit, she was England's Reagan, for all of our American listeners out there. Which, yeah, she was a very kind of trickle-down economics, very fashy economic and social policies. So her statement on homosexuality this year. I'm gonna do my best. Margaret Thatcher. I don't know what she sounds like, but I'm gonna do this accent. Apologies in advance. Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they are have an inalienable right to be gay. Can you imagine? Can you imagine having an being taught that you have an inalienable right to be gay? Disgusting. Disgusting. What are they doing to our children? Yeah, on a more kind of dramatic note, looking at queerness and BDSM in 1987 in the UK, this was the year of Operation Spanner. I was not expecting to find so much in this year, but there's a lot of stuff.
I'm surprised. I'm learning.
Yeah,
I'm drinking it
so
all up.
this began when some cops found a tape containing a recording of some guys doing some consensual BDSM stuff together, including piercings and cutting play in the genital arena. All consensual. It was all fine. But this triggered a search for the men who created this supposed snuff film that snowballed into the mass seizure and persecution of anyone associated with the state of masochistic materials in practice. There were lots of raids on DSM bars and such and so forth at the time. So that's important to the context of this film, as it pulls very much from the BDSM and body modification communities. It's partially inspired by Clive Barker's time as a sex worker and also in the S&M community in his youth. Clive Barker, at the time this movie came out, had not publicly come out as queer yet. That wouldn't happen until 1996. He came out on Loveline. He came out on the radio. That feels appropriate to
Wow.
this. Yeah, it's lovely. We all love and appreciate Clive Barker. Yeah, he came out as gay in 1996. So yeah, another big important piece of history in England regarding horror is the 1984 Film Recordings or Video Recordings Act, which declared that all movies in Britain must be approved by the British Board of Film Classification to be shown and distributed on video. There was a lot of fear of the VHS boom in that people could now get movies not just in theaters but also just buy them on the street, and there was a lot of fear of which could the people be watching? Yeah, so a lot of the gnarlier films that came out of the 70s and 80s were censored and added to a list of video nasties, they were called. You may have heard of these video nasties. This is where they came from. Films that were deemed unclassified, and then they had not gone through the film lore, were illegal to sell. And selling rated 15 to 18 certified videos to underage viewers was a criminal offense. It was very like, think of the children. A lot of it came out of Mary Whitehouse's, campaign against smut and violence and horror. So, all the fun shit.
I haven't heard of that one
Thank you,
before.
White House. You and Anita Bryan are burning happily in hell together. Well, no, she's actually dead. I should look that up. Anyway, once you guys should go and burn in hell with Anita Bryan. So the video nasty list was a list of films deemed unsuitable by the censors, about 72 or so in all. They were mostly B horror films, but it also included some nasty little movies. Movies on that list at one time, because movies would go on and off of that list as they became certified or uncertified, depending, included Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Feast, one of the first splatter movies in the genre, The Evil Dead. That's an infamous splatter film, beloved by many. And Flesh for Frankenstein. That was Andy Warhol's take on Frankenstein from the 70s, which Maku will talk about it. You're gonna love that one. So
I'm
yeah,
interested.
they wanted to kill all the fun stuff. It's fascinating to look at this because you think about a lot of these movies were not shown in England for, decades after this because of this kind of stuff. That's not to say there wasn't a video trade underground. There absolutely was. If you want to learn more about this particular point in history, through a movie, Censor from 2021, directed by Prano Bailey Bond, follows like a censor working in the board. It's very, very good. I would really recommend one. So, production history for this film.
Jennifer Tilly.
So, this is going to be a chunkier episode, I think, just because there is a lot of history and stuff known about Hellraiser. It is a very well-studied film. I think later episodes will have less stuff. But it is based on the book The Hellbound Heart, a novella published by Dark Harvest in the third volume of their Night Visions anthology series in 1986. There are two sequels to the book that I have not read, but I would like to read, including The Scarlet Gospel, and I'm blanking on the title for the second one, so apologies for that. We'll talk about The Hellbound Heart later, I think, in a book episode. There's too much in this episode already, and deserves its own episode. So production for the film began before the book was published. It was Clive Barker's directorial debut. His work had been adapted before, the film Underworld in 1985 and Rawhead Rex in 1986. He wasn't pleased with either of these. I don't think they met his vision. Underworld is particularly hard to track down. It took me a while to find it so I could watch it. I actually really love that film, but I get his concerns if it didn't, meet his particular vision. I'd like to talk about that one at some time. Rawhead Rex, I kind of get. It's a lot of fun, but it's very big. But having read the book it's based on, I completely understand why he's not pleased with it. It's a wild movie though. Anyway, at this point, he figured that the only hands he could trust with his writing is his own. So he decided that he wanted to direct his own film. So he kind of got connected with a friend of a friend, Christopher Figg, who produced the movie. And he also produced Dog Soldiers later, which is an excellent British werewolf movie. If you like big, gnarly action, it's a great one for that. He was nervous going into filming, but he had a lot of very experienced filmmakers and cinematographers, the special effects people and the actors, that he was very, very well supported in this film. So yeah, some of the actors, including Doug Bradley, were old friends from his theater days. He knew them since high school doing theater there and from the theater troupe that they started on their own after graduated. Filming began in 1986. It was pitched and described by Barker as quote unquote family dramas with monsters in it, which very well describes the film. It was really, really low budget. By the end of filming, Clive Barker did the lighting animation himself in the home of, and I quote, a very nice Greek gentleman, while they were both incredibly drunk on quote unquote Greek beer. Lord, to be a fly in a wall in that room. The working title for the film was Sadomasochists from Beyond the Grave, which I would watch that absolutely. At one time on set, when New World Which we'll get to them in a second, said that they didn't like Hellraiser as a title. An elderly lady who was working on set suggested, quote, "What a woman will do for a good fuck," as an alternate title, which also describes this film beautifully. So more funding later down the line would come from New World Pictures, a company originally started by Roger Corman in 1970, who was a champion for cult and B cinema everywhere. We appreciate him a lot. So the setting of this film is kind of infamous in how confusing it is. It was originally filmed and planned to be set in England. After New World became involved, the setting was changed to the States, meaning that several actors, including Kirstie's boyfriend and Frank, Sean Chapman, who was also in Underworld before even knowing the question, which is hilarious to me, were dubbed by American actors. Sean Chapman has talked about his discomfort with this because he was proud of his performance, and I really wish I want to hear that. I want to hear that performance that he did. Doug Bradley was almost dubbed. Thank fuck he wasn't. Can you imagine Pinhead without that voice?
That's crazy.
I no, that's not. Thank God. So yeah, everything was shot on location. That's a real house. The only set in the house is the attic space where Frank emerges from the floor because they needed to do a lot of special effects stuff in there. It's a real house. It was set to be demolished. They were able to get it for cheap. Everything else is on location. They did not have money to build sets. So everything you see in the film is shot on location. The music is by Christopher Young. There's actually an interesting story here. It was originally intended to be composed by the British experimental electronic alt band, Coil. They composed three complete tracks for the film, including a music box theme for the opening of box itself, the lament configuration, as the puzzle box is known. But it sounds a lot like the Chucky film, but or the Chucky theme now, I think is really cool. And the other tracks are pretty good, but ultimately, the Young score blows them out of the water. I'm sorry, Coil. You guys are great. I listened to some of their music for this, and they are very cool. But yeah, this is honestly one of my favorite film scores. Clive Barker as well did come around to the score, in the commentaries I listened to for this. Like the moment it comes on, he's just gushing about how gorgeous it is, which he's completely correct because it's amazing. So that is some of the background details. All right. Are you ready to get into this film?
I'm so ready. I was born
Maybe get
ready.
under the skin.
I think it will thrill you. It may shock you. It might even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to, well, we've warned you.
So yeah, film opens with this amazing music. I've heard this music so much. It was playing through like all the special features on the Blu-rays. I was watching this. And yet I've still been like seeking it out, like just when I'm out in the world, just like putting this music on, and it is still good, and it's still just like, yeah, I feel that like da 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 in my body. It's awesome. Yeah. What are your thoughts on the music now?
It's to me, it's nothing special. It's good, but there are very, very few horror movie scores that have really stood out to me over the years. And this is one that kind of blends in with the rest for me.
Yeah, for me, it's mostly just that kind of like bombastic, gothic, orchestral side of it. It feels so immersive, and like it's just pulling me in and telling me that like, yeah, this grimy little story, that there is something like deeper here, there's something strange and wonderful here.
Yeah, I
But yeah.
agree. I mean, like, I say that it's nothing to write home about, but I agree with you. It does add a lot to the movie because the sets, while the house set is very cool, it is just a house at the end of the day. They don't really dress it up that much. at the very beginning of the movie, we see that Frank has a lot of very strange religious paraphernalia. He's left a lot of food out. It's very messy, and that adds some interest to it. But the rest of the movie, it's very typical. It's kind of boring, but the music sort of adds that feeling that there is something here. It does add that kind of gothic feeling that this old house is haunted with dead things.
Yeah, it's really, really good. Yeah. And one thing I'll say, like, yeah, the house is pretty boring outside of this, but I love those stained glass windows.
The stained glass windows are gorgeous. Yes.
I just love seeing them, yes. So that first quote when we start in this kind of vaguely Asian, Middle Eastern area, this is kind of where we get that kind of uncomfortable 80s, exoticism at the beginning of the film, where like
you get the yellow filter over everything. There's like some kind of string instrument playing in the background.
It's like, oh, 1987. but that first quote, I do like, "What's your pleasure?" is a great way to start the movie. And that quote was actually added in post. It was meant to be a silent scene, I believe, at the beginning. But that really works for me. And then, that's also where we end the film. So I think that aspect of it is, I lied to you. That is actually the only other set in the film is that scene. Because they did not have the money to go shoot it in places that were not England. So yeah, that's that. And then we cut into, honestly, one of the first big set pieces of the film, with Frank kneeling on the floor with his candles, with the lament configuration, that box, summoning the Cenobites for the first time. Yeah. And
he seems like he's having a good time.
He seems like he's having a great time. He's got his candles, he's sitting there absolutely drenched in sweat.
He's damp.
But yeah, and we get the first transformation into the realm of the Cenobites, which every time they show it in the film, it's so simple. Like, you just get blue light leaking in through the slats in the attic, or later in the hospital, through kind of the tile. And it's just, and we get that soundtrack here as well. It's like that bong as we start to change. And it's very simple, but it's really effective. Yeah, what do you think of this nightmare realm with the flesh pillars and everything?
I think it's nice. I think talking about the production history, it makes a lot more sense seeing that now, because the scenes are very dark. You can see like the columns themselves with the hanging body parts and the bits of flesh. They look really good, but you also kind of see the tricks that they're using to make you feel like the place is bigger than it actually is. Like, yeah, you've got, small rotating columns, but you can always zoom in on them and focus on them. You don't have to see the rest of the room, which I kind of like. And they purposely, obviously, keep the rest of the, I guess, hell realm very dark. So you can't really see where you are at any given point. You're just kind of in the void with a couple of weird pillars and a lot of blood on the
floor. I love the set design in this. I don't know. I respect a movie that isn't afraid to just kind of like fill the screen with stuff. And yeah, there's a lot of emptiness around there, but like it really fleshes out the world. Seeing kind of like all the pillars, but then like there's just chains everywhere. There's bits of flesh. The ground is covered in offal. They used real offal from like butchers in these scenes. Nailed the thing. It's a lot cheaper to get real meat and like make fake meat. Yeah, it's just gorgeous. I love this kind of, I mean, we'll get into a lot of this later, but I'll sound like a broken record like that, but the artistry of gore is a really big motif in this film. And I think we really get that, can Pinhead be my interior designer? Can I just, get him to like come in my home and, just artistically nail some meat to the wall? I think that would really improve.
It would really liven the place up.
Mm-hmm, it really would. But yeah, I love the flesh pillars. I love them so much. yeah, it does look like a like a weird art installation. And I could see myself like walking into a room in an art museum or something and just like it being that. And like there being like a plaque on the wall saying like, I don't know, neat world or something like that. And I would eat that shit up. And then we get to like the first hooks, which hooks, that's also going to be a super iconic part of the franchise going forward. And like it looks really fake, like the hooks into the
Oh
skin,
yeah.
but honestly, I don't care. I love practical effects. I don't care if they look bad. That's kind of part of it for me. But even as you can see, like, okay, this is clearly just like a bit of plastic being stretched. I still feel that in my body, just like the hook going into the skin, because they do not skimp on showing you
No, they don't
everything
skimp on
there.
it, but they also they show it for very brief periods of time and they cut away very, very quickly. So it's as if the hook is really coming at you, sinking in really quickly. You feel that jab of pain and then it's gone.
Oh yeah, that's really good. And part of that is the sensors. I think there are scenes here and there that were meant to be kind of extended or longer, but they were made to cut away by the MPAA. I honestly think that works really well for, again, the limited special effects budget
Yeah.
here. But yeah, and then we get like there's well one of my favorite shots in this movie is that bit after he's been pulled apart, or Frank. Uncle Frank has been pulled apart, and you see like his like face puzzled together on the floor.
Oh yeah,
I
yeah.
love it. It's so freaky and weird. But like, yeah, they're at this point they've ripped this man apart, and now we're just playing around with his face. I believe the face was supposed to like melt into the floor, but the special effect didn't work, so they just kind of puzzle it together. But I really love it.
The face looks really good.
The face looks great. Yeah, but like, yeah, watching this last night, I was just sitting there like, I can't imagine. I mean, I don't really remember my experience of watching it for the first time, but like, not knowing anything about this movie and then just going into it, and like, they immediately start with, we're gonna rip you apart and send you to the flesh hell dimension.
To the flesh dimension. Cousin to the shadow realm.
into the shadow realm with you, into the kinky shadow realm. And yeah, they really don't give you a lot of warning, and I respect that so much. I think yeah, that's just they really come on strong with this movie. It really works. So yeah, talking a bit about the Gothic, Mark Richard Adams has a really interesting chapter on this movie from the Palgrave Handbook of the Contemporary Gothic, talking a bit about how this movie kind of modernizes and borrows Gothic motifs, from the focus on the family unit, the haunted house. We literally have a mad creature in the attic. We have a Faustian bargain with demons, as we'll talk about in a second. But it kind of doesn't conform to the Christian religious trappings of the genre that you see a lot. Like the symbols and aesthetics are there. Like we'll talk a bit about Frank's like weird Catholic shrines, but they're very explicitly not Christian demons. This is not a Christian cosmology that we're dealing with these kind of Gothic aesthetics here, which I think is very fun and kind of shows a real development of the Gothic genre. How do you feel about this? This film is a, I don't know, I might call it a neo-Gothic.
It is certainly gothic. And like we were talking about, the music adds to the gothicness. The fact that we're in an old house adds to it. There's some weird, unexplained, I guess you'd call them like harbingers. I might be getting ahead of myself here, but when I was watching it, I completely forgot about that weird bug-eating guy that is revealed to be a demon at the end, who kind of acts as a warning for Kirstie about halfway through the film. I feel like that's very gothic. And also the fucking and the
Obviously
eroticism and the weird
the
incest vibes, that's all
Yeah,
standard
yeah.
gothic
Incest
stuff.
is very gothic. Like I don't know. I see a lot of people who like will go back and read some of the older stories or like see incest tropes in like modern gothic pieces and like get squicked out about it, which I mean fair, it is squicky, but also I'm sitting
It's
here like
gross.
that's kind of part of it, man.
Yeah.
That's one of
Like,
the core
sorry? That's
things.
the point.
Ugh. Like, yeah, people got really freaked out with like Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak when like spoilers for that
Oh
movie.
yeah,
We'll get to it.
I wasn't expecting it, that's for sure.
Big incest twist in that movie and people freaked out. And I'm like, that's the genre, babe. I'm so sorry. I don't enjoy this either, but that's kind of part of it. So yeah, before we get into the rest of the film, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the sadomasochistic side of this film. There's a lot. So sadism comes from the Marquis de Sade, who is the author of a series of erotic novels in the mid 1700s. Masochism, they're about 100 words, 100 years removed, these words, which I thought was interesting, is from Leopold von Sacher Masoch, who is an Austrian writer working in the mid 1800s. He did not like that this particular word was assigned to him. Bless you. Bless you, Leopold. I'm so sorry, but he was into that from what we know. So good for him.
Good for him.
But yeah, so again, like many things, there's lots of different theories about the reasons behind sadomasochism. There's not a single theory of why people are into it to describe the vast diversity of people who practice it. The most relevant flavor of sadomasochistic theory for Hellraiser is the idea of erotic transformation and destruction of the self-identity. A lot of theorists have talked about this particular flavor of say of S&M theory, including Foucault, who followed the ancient Greeks, who also talked about this particular kind of eroticism in this way. We've been freaks forever. Kink is not a new thing. Sartre, also, apologies if I'm pronouncing that wrong. He wrote on sadomasochism that if people can be objects, they don't have to worry about being free subjects, namely having transcendence or future possibilities for action. They can be like objects, just be what they are with nothing to worry about. So if people can reduce others to objects, then they too don't have to be threatened by transcendence. So yeah, I think Hellraiser very much literalizes the transformation and dissolution of body and mind. As we said before, Frank gets sexually exploded
He sure does.
in like a complete literal dissolution of the body and the mind in pleasure and pain. We'll get to later the transformation of the Cenobites themselves in the ways that kink and sexual fantasy expand our conception of what is possible, as in like the creation of fantasies of sexual play in sadomasochism, which I think is very cool. Yeah, there's also a lot to talk to here about the power dynamics, particularly between Julia and Frank, kink as kind of a simulation of heteronormative dynamics. But there's a lot of problems with how Frank engages with this particular kind of kink, which again, we'll get into later. I have thoughts. So yeah, moving on to these first couple of scenes, we have the family entering the home once more, the family dynamic at the center of this film that we've been touching on. So we have Larry, played by Andrew Robinson. We have Julia, played by Claire Higgins, my queen. She didn't do a lot of other horror films after this. I think she's mostly in dramas, but she was a very acclaimed theater actor before this. Andrew Robinson, however, was cast because of his work in Dirty Harry. He was a big kind of like crazy villain in that one, which we'll get to. He'll get to stretch those particular chops a bit later. And later, Kirsty, Kirsty Cotton, which now these are the Cotton family, who is played by Ashley Lawrence. This was her first movie. She'd done theater acting before this, but this was her first movie. Which Mac, I don't think you're ready for this fact I'm about to share with you. Do you want to guess who else was up for the role before?
I don't know a lot of actors from the 80s. I don't know.
No. Do you have a guess?
I don't.
Okay. This is gonna blow your brains. Jennifer Tilly was almost our
Oh,
Kirstie.
I would not have guessed that. Okay.
Yeah, Miss
Wild.
Jennifer
Okay.
Tilly. That would have been a
That's crazy.
completely
That would have been
different
a completely
movie.
different movie.
Yeah. I
Young
mean, I'd
Jennifer
love
Tilly
to.
as Kirstie
Oh, the
Cotton. That's
hell, Pinhead.
crazy.
I mean, I'd eat it up, but I As much as I love Jennifer Tilly, as much as I'm dedicated and worship the altar of Miss Tilly, I do think that Ashley was the right choice for this
I
one. I
can't,
think.
I honestly can't imagine Kirstie being played by anybody else.
Yeah, I mean she's amazing.
Yeah.
I like I said, I think that having these two giant, kind of diva characters, playing off each other would have it would have been a different movie. Like, can you imagine like Tilly going up against Julia? Which is,
Yeah.
oh my God. Yeah, so we have Larry and Julia heading into this kind of semi-abandoned house that Frank has been living in for a while, and it is decorated with his weird horny collection of his homemade pornography. We have some weird little sex dolls, and also a lot of Catholic shrines and such. I think prominently going into this film, I paused it and zoomed in, but there is like fully a Salome statue, with the head of John the Baptist on a platter. I think it's Salome. There's no other kind of Christian saint or religious character that carries heads on platters that I know of. So, are you familiar with that story?
I'm not.
Oscar Wilde wrote a play based on that particular Bible story. It is the Princess Salome. Who was responsible for the beheading of John the Baptist, and she wanted his head on a silver platter. Yeah, we'll talk a bit down the line, I think, about that story. It's very good. Anyway, not good for John the Baptist, but
Yeah.
the play is very
Well,
good.
maybe he had it coming. I don't know. He was
Yeah,
just
a little
baptizing too many
questionable.
people.
He was one of the okay apostles. He was a pretty he was a decent dude. For all of his apostling. So yeah, that's that. But yeah, we get a call from Kirstie here, who is very deliberately not going to be staying with her dad and Julia. We get a hint at the tension between Kirstie and Julia here, which will come into play later. But also good for you, Kirstie, setting those boundaries. Think later. Yeah, we get then we move in, which. The secondhand stress. I hate moving. I hate it
Oh,
so
yeah.
much. I hate it. So I'm with Julia here. Absolutely. Moving is terrible. So we come and we have these two like vaguely creepy moving men. Fun fact, the second moving man is Oliver Parker. I think he's the one with the dark hair. So he would go on to do some wild adaptations. He would adapt some Oscar Wilde films. So he made an adaptation of The Importance of Being Earnest and that one Dorian Gray movie with Ben Barnes and Colin Firth. Do you ever see that
Oh, I
one?
haven't seen that one. I want to.
We'll get to it. It's kind of horrible, but it's very early 2000s. Like
That's what
queer
I've heard.
baiting.
Yeah,
Oh,
yeah. I've heard the soundtrack, weirdly enough, and
interesting.
I was like, oh, it's a Dorian Gray movie. It'll be good for my, like dark academia
Yeah.
playlist. And I listened to two songs. And I was like, what the fuck is this?
That's kind of yeah,
What is this
it's very
Queen of the Damned
oversaturated.
shit?
It's it is some queen of the damn shit. Oh, it's so stupid. Anyway, they also met him in the theater days, interestingly enough. Doug Bradley, who plays Pinhead, had the choice to either play this moving man or Pinhead. Like one of these, like
Wild.
Oliver Parker, who is the moving man, was almost Pinhead. They like he swapped and he like he thought about it for a while because I think that just speaks to just how minor they thought Pinhead was going to be, that he
Yeah.
was kind of put on the same level as this random moving man role. So yeah, he was not the focus of this movie. I think that just puts that in perspective. So yeah, and as we are unpacking the boxes and going through this house, Julia starts flashing back to her first meeting with Frank. And it's very steamy indeed. So we get a flashback to them. They meet on like I think it's the day before the wedding. Yeah. And yeah, he shows up to her house and immediately seduces her. And we get flashbacks to their sex scene. In between, as they're moving this stupid mattress,
Oh, right, because yeah, so the mattress is stuck on the stairs or something. They're trying to move it up. The staircase is too narrow, so they're trying to turn it, and they're trying to force it in, and it cuts in between that and Frank just like pounding into Julia upstairs on the bed. It's like such a crazy scene, and I had totally forgotten about it.
Yeah, the parallels, it's this is what's such an insane but brilliant way to film this. Because yeah, the parallels is like we're moving the marital bed as like we're getting flashbacks to them fucking on the marital bed. So another fun fact, and the MPAA returns for more, is that they limited the amount of thrusts we could get for this sex scene. There was a number of thrusts we were allowed to do. I think Clive originally had about six thrusts. He had to cut it down to three thrusts.
Was it only three? It
Only
felt like more than
three.
three when I
There's
was
only
watching it.
three. Well, that's the trick of it. I think we make up for a lot of the thrusting by having the mattress thrusting its way up the stairs.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that's a great way to get around that. But there was also a previous version filmed with spanking. Which that footage is still out there. The spanking cut of
Someone's got
Hellraiser
it.
theoretically exists in a someone's basement somewhere, and I want that. Where is it? Whoever, if you have it, talk to us.
Call us.
Talk to me. I just want that. It's for me. So yeah, another thing I noticed as I was watching this sex scene is that he like pushes her down out of the bed right on top of the wedding dress. Fucked on her wedding dress the night before her wedding to his brother. It was insane. Oh, the audacity of it all. Yeah, I noticed that for the first time watching it this time, and I was like, oh my God, you guys. But yeah, and so as we are shoving this mattress up the stairs, oh no, there's a nail. That's what you see a lot in a lot of movies. Like if there's a nail scare coming up, you will show the nail and then you'll be bracing yourself until it happens. And I
Oh
love it.
yeah. Oh
Oh,
yeah.
it's so gnarly.
True in Home Alone, true in Hellraiser.
Larry slices open his arm on the nail, and he goes up and drips blood all over the floor in the attic. Become relevant later. And they do a really cool reverse shot as the blood seeps into the floor. Just it's a very simple trick, but it looks amazing. And then that leads into my personal favorite scene in this movie, which is the rebirth of
Oh, it's
Frank
definitely the
Cotton.
best scene. Yeah.
Good. I mean, before we like, but they get a hint of it that like he's kind of still there, like there's like some flesh under the floorboards, and we get like a little Frank sack down there.
It's like kind of like a beating heart attached to the floorboards, but you're not really sure
It's
what it
like
is.
breathing down there. We get Frank's breathing sack. New band name.
New
Frank's on
band name just dropped.
band
Frank's
name
breathing
just
sack.
dropped. Oh, Frank's breathing sack. Yeah, there's a reason this room needed to be a set. They needed to do a lot of different stuff in here. I think originally they did not have this scene. This was all filmed in post. But they needed a more kind of dramatic moment in this movie and a more dramatic kind of resurrection. So this scene is all puppetry and stop motion and reverse shots. I mean, it's a lot of those things, but like every kind of stage of Frank's rebirth is a different puppet that does different things. That was kind of, gooped and degooped and regooped in reverse. When it gets to the music, but like the music as well, the score is really interesting here because it's kind of a waltz. That's the rhythm of it is kind of the resurrection or a triumphant waltz that I absolutely love. But yeah, it just looks like he like the weird puppet emerges out of a pile of snot, and it's disgusting and it's wonderful. And I honestly I have trouble kind of articulating my thoughts about this moment. It's just so beautiful and so strange. And yeah, like you can kind of, I mean, if you know how special effects work, you can kind of like watch this and see how they did all of it, but it still looks amazing.
It does,
It's
yeah.
not. It's not super shuddery. It's everything flows really well, literally.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's goopy, it's nasty, it's gross. Yeah, the like reverse shots of kind of rebuilding on the hands and the close up and the detail of it. I've said it before and I've said it again. Practical effects will always work better for me. Because you can feel it, you can see that there's something there. And just the amount of dampness as well on here makes a lot of difference in perceiving something as real. I think looking at a story I heard, Friend of the Thing, which we'll definitely get to that one at some point. They built all of the puppets and the creatures for the big transformation sequences, and they were looking at it, and it was like, oh, you know, this doesn't look real. This looks super fake. And then one of the special effects guys was like, oh, just spray it with water. Just get it wet. And it's like, oh yeah, this is kind of the ultimate expression of that because everything is covered in weird. It's not like fluids and blood and. This is a really movie for ambiguous goop everywhere. We've got various the wide rainbow textures and colors of goop in this movie, and I love that. Yeah, I'm just absolutely transfixed by this scene. I could gush about it forever. Yeah, but yeah, what are this is I mean this is definitely my favorite moment in the film. If you have any.
Also mine. I don't think I have a lot more to add to it. You really nailed it. It's Frank's literal regrowth. He starts
I love
off
it.
as that weird heart thing beating underneath the floorboards. And then from what I remember, he starts growing. I think the first shot of him coming up through the floorboards is these two weird spindly kind of spider-like arms. They don't have hands, they just have like the kind of elbow joint, but they come up through the floorboards, they come down, they try to grip it, and then slowly he starts to rebuild himself. He kind of grows a spinal cord, he grows his ribs together, the goop on the
I
floor
love
becomes his
that shot of the
brain.
ribs of just kind of the blood pooling around them. It's
Yeah,
absolutely
that's a
beautiful.
beautiful one. And I love the shot of his hands growing back. At first they're kind of nubs, and then you see the kind of square part of his palm, and then slowly his fingers start extending outward. Just super, super cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like, yeah, it comes out, it's just like this vague arm-shaped blob, and then you just like, what is that thing? And then it slowly becomes a person. I think that's kind of the more disturbing part of it, is that yeah, underneath it all we are just like weird goop and flesh and bones and gross stuff. And that's part of kind of the special things about this movie is that it's very concerned with peeling away the outer edges and showing the nasty stuff before, like again with the family as well, with the goop.
And in the
But
final shot of that scene as well, I think that's one of the only times where we're absolutely sure that it's some kind of humanoid thing. But he
it
kind of,
screams.
he screams, he arches his back, he looks up towards the sky, he just yells, and then it cuts away. I'm like, oh, sorry, buddy. That's
I feel
rough.
like that's a horror, like, oh, you could really feel it as a horrible way to exist. And then we go to this dinner scene, which I love that we cut straight from the thing in the attic scene to the dinner scene because,
Very gothic.
very gothic. Clive Barker was talking about on the commentary, he was talking about, like, you know, Hitchcock talks a lot about the bomb under the table. That, like, things are more stressful if you know there's a bomb under the table. So, like, all of these people are having these, you know, this normal dinner conversation, and you are just constantly, we're like, there is something above you. There is something in the attic. We don't know what it is yet at this point. We're just like, there's a thing up here. But yeah, a fun fact about this scene, the actor that gets up and says goodbye to Julia as she leaves for the evening, in the red sweater. So he was, this is a Kenneth Nelson. He was in The Boys in the Band, which is a very famous queer film from the 70s. So we have some more queer connections there, as if we needed more. But yeah, another thing I noticed on this watch is that for pretty much all of the movie, Kirstie is in white. Like, she enters the movie in this white blouse. She spends this whole scene in this like completely white outfit. And then she wears like a white t-shirt, I think, for the rest of the film. But yeah, I think that's really interesting as well, considering the fairy tale influence that Booker included in this. Because we have a wicked stepmother. We have, monsters and such, and fairy Kirsty is very much kind of the central innocent, pure figure, the Snow White to the Evil Queen, if you will. So I think that's neat. Yeah. Anyway, so then we move up to Julia discovering Frank in the attic, who is now played by Oliver Smith. There will be four actors who play Frank in this movie. There's
Wow.
John Chapman, who is the original porn star looking guy from the flashback scenes. And then we have Oliver Smith, who is him in the skin suit. Oliver, I think he was chosen just because he was so thin that they could get the suit over him and still have it look like there's a person under there, so he wouldn't look too bulky. But you get like a lot of thin actors who have made careers out of being in skin suit. Like Doug Jones is probably one of the more well-known ones.
That makes sense.
And then yeah, the third actor is, I mean, we'll get spoilers, we'll get Andrew Robinson to play Frank later, and then of course the guy who dubbed him over in an American accent. So yeah,
Right, yeah.
Frank is a man of many with many faces in this
Takes a
film.
village to be
It
one guy.
takes the village to play a pervert. It really does. yeah. So yeah, what do you think of this makeup, of this first Frank?
First Frank, that's when
He's all
he's all red and
like
sticky, right?
brownish and gray.
Oh, no, you're right. I forgot about
Yeah,
that.
we get
I
many
think
stages of Frank.
My favorite stage is, I think, the second stage of Frank
That's a
when
good
he
one.
is in the bright red skin suit and you can see all of his muscles. He looks like a I'm trying to remember what the name of that exhibit was, but it was like I think it was just the body. And it was a traveling exhibit for quite a while. I know it was like on the West Coast for a while in Vegas. But it was just a bunch of figures of the human body without their skin on, doing
This sounds
various things. And
cool.
that's what it always makes me think of. It always.
So yeah, this creature design is one of kind of the more singular things about this movie, because we see skeletons everywhere. Skeletons are very common in horror and Halloween imagery and such. But you rarely see them with kind of the muscles and the tendons. You're really seeing that in between stage between the skeleton and the skin
It's like a
buildup.
cross between a I guess like a skeleton and a zombie, right?
Exactly, yeah. But you don't see that as much outside of like, well, anatomy textbooks and like, art. So I really love seeing that here. Because we're weird under there. We're weird underneath our skin. And it's really cool to see that. I think it's very abject in the way that this is close to us, as in this is in our own bodies, but we are so repelled by it. It's very kind of uncanny, almost human yet not sort of
Very
thing.
Freudian.
Exactly. Yeah, we could get real Freudian about this. God damn it. So yeah, I
I
know
just
Claire
finished
Higgins.
The Uncanny a couple days
Oh, you just
ago,
read that?
so I've got a lot of
Yeah.
thoughts about it, yeah.
Oh yeah, me too. I think he makes some really good points at the beginning of that, and then he just kind
And
of
then he
goes
just
off the
devolves
rails into
into,
being like,
everybody
oh,
has a
and
castration
becoming
complex, right?
blind means that you're castrated, actually. And it's like,
Yeah.
all right, buddy.
Yeah,
Okay.
let's get you to bed, old man.
All right. Time to go to bed, Grandpa.
Yeah.
But yeah, Claire Higgins, she could not eat lunch on days when she worked with Skin Frank.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, which tracks. I think Baby Frank, when we get kind of the moment where she's going in the door and you see like that creature like crawling towards the camera. I think it was originally a puppet, but that didn't work. So that is actually a child in like a full skin suit
Interesting.
crawling around. And you see it very briefly, but it's really creepy. Just like the way it moves and how small it is. And it's, oh, I love it. Yeah, Frank at this point gets Julia to agree to go kill a man for him very easily. She
Very, very easily, yeah.
very easily, like it's really bad. I think like she doesn't want to do it at first, but then they cut to like a scene of her like lying dead, like not dead, but like she looks dead inside, lying next to Larry in bed. This poor man. And she's like, the dick is too good.
Yeah.
Like, he must have been really good, man. I don't.
It must have been crazy. Yeah.
It must have been crazy good. I don't know. Yeah, I do not understand myself. But you know, I guess if Jennifer Tilly without her skin asked me to commit murder, I can't say that I would refuse. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. But yeah, so, and then we cut to like the first kind of extended hunting scene with Julia, because that's what it is. It is she gone hunting.
She is the slasher in this movie.
She is the slasher in this movie. Like, if this movie has a slasher element, it is Julia, and I love that so much. This is a good point to talk about Julia in general, because she is the focus of this film. I think for Clive Barker, she is the main character. She has the most pronounced arc throughout the movie. And yeah, I don't know. She's a murder diva, and I love her very much. What are your thoughts about
her? Yeah, Kirsty is definitely the protagonist, but Julia, it makes sense that she's the main character. She does get the most, well, I don't want to say character development. She gets worse throughout the film.
She develops,
like, she actively becomes a worse human being.
Yeah.
But she also, she does the most in the film as well. Like, she's the one who goes up to the attic. She is the reason why Larry goes up to her and shows her his dripping nail wound, because he can't handle blood and she can. So she's the reason why Frank gets resurrected. She is the reason why Frank continues to grow, because she brings him fresh meat, for lack of a better word. She seduces a bunch of men, brings them up to the attic, and either she kills them with a hammer or Frank does. She, oh man, that's most of what she does. And then by the end of the film, she meets a grisly fate.
Yeah, poor Larry though.
He gets cooked. I mean,
he's not a very boring guy. He is like your standard some guy. Bless him. I don't think he ever actually does anything wrong. He's just like kind of a dork. I feel very bad for him by the end of this movie.
You feel bad for him. I don't know. There were some moments with him where I felt like he knew a little bit of what was going on. Not necessarily that Frank was coming back to life in his own house, but there were a couple of moments that made me feel like he kind of played the what's the term, like, straw man sometimes on purpose. Like at the dinner scene when Julia is saying goodbye to everybody, she gives all of her guests a hug and a kiss, and then she looks at him and leaves without so much as touching him.
So right.
And he kind of like glares after her like, oh, like I know that you don't love me anymore, you fucking bitch. And then there's a scene much later in the movie. This is after Julia has hunted a bunch of people. They're watching like boxing together downstairs, I think, and there's a storm, and Frank upstairs, I don't remember what he's doing, but he makes a loud noise. He's throwing temper tantrum, I don't know. But Larry's like, oh, I wonder if I left the window open, I'll go see what it is. And Julia, who doesn't want him to discover Frank, is like, no, don't do that. Do you want to have sex? And Larry's like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so we'll they start doing that,
and it turns out Frank is staring at them from in their closet. He comes out
in the
closet. Yeah, while you know, he comes out while Larry is going down on Julia, and Julia is watching Frank. And Frank, I don't remember what he says. He's like, he's mad. He's got a dead rat that he like.
He's skinning a rat.
Yeah, and he's, I guess, threatening to kill Larry, and Julia starts screaming, no, no, no. And the scene goes on for like 30 seconds.
It's one of the like harder to watch scenes, because it's not just, you know, the gore that's happening, but it's kind of the stress of discovery. It's the threat that, like, you know, she's in lust with this man, but he is threatening to her as much as he is to like the rest of the world.
And it's not just that, but going back to my theory about Larry does not stop.
He doesn't.
Continues trying to fuck her for, you know, the whole time, while she's clearly in distress, while she's saying no, 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 like, not necessarily to him,
but uncomfortable.
Even so, which kind of makes me feel like maybe he kind of knows. Maybe he kind of knows what he's doing.
Interesting.
I don't know. That's just a little theory.
No, I like that,
that
a lot. I had not. I've never. Yeah, I don't know. I've never suspected this man of anything. But that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Talking briefly about the relationship between Frank and Julia, and like their kind of engagement with Kate and BDSM. I think. Yeah, I have thoughts about this. So Frank doesn't seem super interested in the play aspect as much in BDSM. Like, he's very clearly in this because of power, and he wants to feel powerful. He wants to be dominant over the people in his life. And I think we get that with kind of his expressions of power over Julia. Like, this is not an equal relationship. I never feel once that he's interested in the in giving up any power at all, which is really, really interesting to me, especially like given that the Cenobites flavor of BDSM is very much kind of like giving in and transforming the body and the mind in, like, you know, the soup of pleasure and pain. And I don't think Frank is willing to do that. I don't think he knows what he's getting into, really. I think he's looking for kind of the extremes of sensation, but he's not actually willing to surrender power in any way.
That plays into why the ending and Julia's death. Like, the reason why he kills her is because he isn't willing to share that power even with her.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, he killed her by accident. Then he's like, well, I'm just going to eat you anyway because love.
Was
love
it by accident,
him.
Though?
Well, he's trying to get to Kirsty.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's just another theory. I don't know.
No, this is interesting. No, this is good stuff. Yeah, but I mean, if you notice that when he gets out of hell, when he gets out of the Cenobites, he's desperate not to go back in. So, like, clearly whatever he felt and got there is not what he actually wanted. So I you know, I think Frank is actually a bit too vanilla for what the Cenobites are into. That's my thought.
And he doesn't get the concept of BDSM.
He doesn't get this particular flavor of BDSM, because I think there's kind of like a mixture here of kind of topping and bottoming, like in a way that, you know, it is about giving up control. It is about letting someone else play upon your body, of letting your body be destroyed. And he can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying that if he'd let Sarah Higgins peg him a little bit, we wouldn't be having this conversation? Maybe.
Maybe.
I'm saying that.
Maybe.
maybe. But yeah, overall, you know, we talk about Frank as this great libertine in the context of this film, but like, yeah, I think just the comparison between him and the Cenobites, he's not ready for this kind of level of kink and kind of surrender
that they are.
And I think that shows kind of a lot of his immaturity and his kind of, you know, patriarchal obsession with power. Like, yeah, he clearly sees BDSM not as like a transformative, explorative process, but as an extension of his like obsession with control.
Absolutely.
And yeah, that's why he's not ready for what he gets. Yeah, but moving on. Back to this murder scene for a second. I love Julia's outfit in this scene. She has these amazing star earrings that
I was gonna bring those up.
Yes! So good. I want them.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, yeah. She's got her star earrings. She's got that like comb over hair look that like adds 2 inches to her height. She's got the shoulder pads. It's like ultimate 80s step MILF, and I love everything about it. It's so good. Yeah, so she kills this first guy, and he's kind of an asshole, so he had it coming. I feel no sympathy for this man. But yeah, after the first kill, this is another one where we got some censor issues. They only allowed 2 hammer whacks on this guy that could be shown. So we were limited a bit. But yeah, one of my favorite, this is another really good shot in this film, because after she commits the murder and Frank is out there slurping up this guy, she like goes into the bathroom and like strips off her shirt, and she's wearing this like black lingerie and like this black necklace, and she's just covered in blood spatter, and she just stares at herself in the mirror in this like this cold, cold lighting. And I absolutely love it because this is like a moment of transformation for her, and it's a very evocative moment.
Yeah, you can tell she didn't enjoy it. And in that bathroom scene, you can see that she's shaking a little bit as she washes her hands, but then she continues to keep on doing it. So who knows?
Yeah, it's really good. Like, yeah, this is the moment in her evolution. But yeah, then we get our next stage of Frank, which is tendoned Frank.
Yeah,
Muscles
Tendon
now.
Frank, the
Tendoned
best
Frank,
Frank.
and he's oh, it's so goopy. He's dripping. I don't think there's a scene we see skinless Frank where he is not dripping some kind of vague fluid,
Oh,
and
yeah.
it's great. It's just great. I love it. This is also where we get the quote because she's like, "Yeah, I'm not doing this again. I can't do this again." And so he tempts her into like he says, like, "You want me to have more flesh, don't you, Julia?" And I was
Right,
like,
yeah, something like
"What?
that.
Where
And
do
she
you
like
want that
she
flesh,
kisses his
Julia?"
hand and you're like, "Oh, there's no skin there,
She always like, "Oh,
Julia."
you put that in your mouth. Where do you know where that's been?"
Yes.
Disgusting. Yeah, and I love this quote. Like it's I think it's one of the first times I noticed what he says here because he says it really quietly, but he says like, "Yeah, like we'll run away together, we'll have everything, we'll have this like love but real." Which,
Right, yeah.
that's such an interesting quote, especially like, on Valentine's Day today. But yeah, this is not romantic. This is a carnal relationship that like he doesn't believe in love. And like I don't think she does at this point either. But yeah, they are really just bodies to each other. Like she is a means to an end for him. He needs her. Like I think he's attracted to her, but like mostly he needs her to bring him bodies. And I think at this point, like she's into him and she's attracted to him, but he's a sex toy.
Oh, for sure.
He's
Yeah.
a big, big,
Well,
gross sex toy.
he's an important sex toy.
He's a
He
very
like
important sex
represents
toy.
her sexual freedom and liberation
Yes,
in
absolutely.
a certain
From
way.
poor Larry, who has
Yeah.
never gone down on a woman in his life. And then yeah, after this scene, so we get like a montage of a couple more kills, and we get this is another. I keep saying one of my favorite shots. There's just so many good ones in this movie. Of kind of like the camera's moving in on Julia. She's sitting like in her like white blouse with her drink at on like on a couch, and she's just like. He has like this is the ascension of the transit. Like we are telling you, like oh, she is down to clown. She has reached her ultimate evil stepmommy moment. And then like right before the cut of the scene, like her face is like dead. And then right before the scene cuts, we get this like slow little like quirk at the corner of her mouth. Like, oh, it's just good. Claire Higgins, I can't stress how good she is in this
She's
movie.
fantastic.
And we get this neat little shot of Oliver Smith in the skin suit smoking, which I think
Oh,
leads back
yeah.
to that the body exhibit that you were talking about earlier of just like the weird man doing normal human stuff. I think this was they saw Oliver Smith in the costume smoking offset, and they were like, "That looks cool," so they put him in the movie, and they were right; it looks cool.
It does look cool.
So yeah. And we get to the thunderstorm scene that we talked about briefly before. I think we covered most of that. One thing to note, there is a thunderstorm in all three of Clive Barker's directed films. That's this one, Nightbreed, and then Lord of Illusions in the mid-90s. Which I didn't know that I didn't notice, but it's neat. Yeah, one more thing I want to say about this scene before we move on is like I don't know what Frank is doing in that room, but he's clearly causing problems on purpose. Like we get to a
Oh,
cut,
for
like
sure.
he's been nailing rats to walls, and I'm sitting like, what is he doing up there for days? Yeah, homegirl needs some enrichment in his enclosure.
Give him
Give
a book at least. Give him a
him a
fucking
book,
magazine to read.
I mean, no puzzles, that's for sure.
No puzzles.
No puzzles, but like get this guy like a word search, like one of those like little craft booklets from the dollar store.
Something that
He
you don't
needs
mind
something
getting
to
wet.
do. Yeah, I mean, it would get damp. Maybe like a crochet kit. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe make a pinhead doll. I want one of those now. Like you could use like real like little jeweled pins. That'd be so cute. Yeah, now I'm just imagining like him up there with like a word search, like finding every way to spell sex that you can. Oh God. Horrible. Anyway, one more thing. So in the sex scene, or like the almost sex scene, at the thunderstorm, there's like a painting on the wall that you can see. My grandmother has that painting.
Whoa! Oh
Yes.
my
My
God.
grandmother has that painting. I remember since I was a child, she had to take it off the wall because I had a cousin who thought it was haunted. So it like sat in a room, and I remember seeing that thing. Like staying at my grandmother's house when I was a child. It does look haunted. It has dead,
Wow.
freaky eyes. So yeah, it's very appropriate for this movie. Yeah, and then we get to this scene in the Chinese restaurant, which they did film in an actual restaurant for this. But yeah, this leads to one of my favorite cut in this movie. Because like, yeah, Larry and Kirstie are just talking, and they're like, oh, you should try to connect with your stepmom. You guys should like try to talk to each other. And like at the end of the scene, he's like, oh, I don't know, maybe she just needs someone to talk to. And then it cuts to like Frank standing on the stairs, like in his horrible flesh, her horrible flesh boyfriend standing on the stairs, like maybe she just needs someone to talk to. Flesh boyfriend. Yeah, so then we get to like the last kill scene. And I think this is the most we get out of like the aftermath of Frank sucking down these guys. Which there's some homoeroticism in that,
Oh,
at the
sure.
very least. The Foley for this scene. Like he's just sucking on this guy, and it sounds like the end of a milkshake. It sounds exactly like that. It's oh. Oh, so many good flesh noises. But yeah, so Kirstie's going over and she's like, okay, Dad, I'm gonna try to connect with my stepmom. And what does she see but her stepmother bringing another man home? And then, oh no, it's worse. It's
It's
worse.
worse than adultery.
She goes upstairs and is like, oh, my skinned uncle is fucking my stepmom. All right. And
Yeah,
they're murdering
fantastic.
people. It's this is great. This is continuation of Kirstie's no good, very bad week.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like she gets out of there, she gets the box. Something
Oh,
I wrote down.
right. Yeah, yeah,
Yeah.
yeah, yeah.
The
'Cause I think
design of this of the Lament configuration. It was designed, I'm blanking on his name. Apologies for the designer of the box, but he was very, very protective of these boxes. So there was a series of boxes made that could do all the different things it does. Like, is it like warps and turns and all the bits come out. There's a different box for every one of those scenes, and they're just cooked together. Yeah, he was super, super protective of these boxes because they were fragile and they were very well made. So yeah, when Kirstie throws that box out the window, he
I was
was
just
waiting
about to
on the
bring that up.
ground to catch it.
But she finds the box and she grabs it, I think, as something to like defend herself with, possibly. And all of a sudden he just totally changes. His countenance completely flips. And he's like, what are you doing with that box? You
Put
don't
it
want to touch
down.
that box. It's really dangerous. And then she looks at it, she looks at him, she looks
To
a
get
little
some
bit behind
power.
him. And she's like, you want it? Go get it. And she just fucking chucks it right out the window and sprints down the stairs.
Oh, so good.
It was so satisfying to see.
It's very good.
Like she didn't fight him off, but she didn't need to. She was smart with it.
Oh,
She
yeah.
was really quick on her feet. And I just love that. And she runs downstairs, she runs out of the house, grabs the box, and she just starts running in any direction
Oh, it's
just to
yeah.
get away from there.
Yeah, and then like there's a point in the film where like she passes by a pair of nuns that do nothing to help her.
I think like directly after that, yeah.
Yeah, and Clive Barker, he was very particular about that film because like yeah, Catholicism kind of haunts the edges of this movie as well. Like it's there in aesthetics, but there's not a lot of flesh to it. Yeah, if any listeners are drinking every time we say flesh in this episode, you will die. Don't do that.
We should have
But
started the
yeah, like
episode
the
off with that. Don't take a
yeah.
shot every time.
Don't take a shot. Don't do that. You'll die. But yeah, like I said, like with the aesthetics of Catholicism, like in the house, that he likes to play with, because you know, Catholicism is a very kinky religion. Let's be real, they're weird
Oh,
about
100%.
pain. I mean, the Protestantism I grew up with was also weird about pain, but we were like, I know Protestants are less fun about it anyway. The fact that these nuns go right by her and do nothing to help, even though she's clearly like in distress. Yeah, there's no kind of substance to what they preach in that particular moment. It's an interesting moment. Yeah, so then we cut to the hospital where the nurse is watching her favorite show, Sped Up Our Art House Flowers,
I love
while
that. I
Perseus
watch
is
that
on
every
bed.
Sunday.
Yeah, that's my favorite show. Yeah, like your Saturday mornings is the sped up flower in time lapse. And yeah, then we get so she's playing with the box for the first time, and we get yeah
Presumably,
probably
locked up in the hospital because
yeah like a
she,
penis
like, she
hospital
ran
right
from the house, and they probably blame her for the murder of, like, the most recent
Well,
guy,
no one
right?
knows about the murders yet.
Oh,
She's
okay.
just in the hospital because she was stumbling around on the street and she passed out.
I always thought that they treated her so strangely. They were like,
They
oh,
really do.
don't leave this room, or like,
I,
oh, don't you,
yeah.
like, I don't
I
know.
think it's because they think she's high or something. I think
Oh,
that's
okay,
what
that
it
makes
is.
sense.
Yeah. But yeah, so she opens up this box and we get that cheesy 80s lightning that I love so much that Clive Barker literally scribbled onto the film. I love cheesy 80s lightning. And then we get, you know, the engineer, my close personal friend, the engineer, as she
I
opens
didn't know
up
that was the
this,
name.
that is what it's called. All of the Cenobites have very intricate backstories that Clive Barker wrote for them. Why this guy is called the engineer, I have no idea. I would kill to read those. But yeah, I love the creature design on this thing.
It's so
Really
good.
deeply
It
weird.
you won't know this reference, but some of the listeners might. In one of the, I think it's the most recent Resident Evil games, one of the very minor enemies, and I don't remember the name of it, is a very similar creature to the engineer, but it's like a kind of reversed engineer, so like big mouth
Reverse, so
up on
a reverse
top, and it like it
engineered
fills the entire
reverse engineer.
corridor where it chases the main character down. Like that was my first connection when I watched the
Yeah,
movie.
so a reverse engineered reverse engineer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, one thing I love about this is like if you look like just below it, you can fully see. But yeah, if you look at like just below it, you can fully see the cart that it's being like pushed down this hallway on, like
That's
the
crazy. I
guy
didn't
like
know
running
that.
behind it, and I love it so much. It's and yeah, then we get the first time that, well, I guess this is the second time that we meet the Cenobites in this movie, but it's wild. This is like we're like getting close to like 1 hour and 10 minutes into this movie, and we've barely seen
We
Pain.
finally see the
We
Cenobites
finally
in person.
see the Cenobites for an extended scene. We saw them briefly before. We get them for a while here. And yeah, we get like that switch as the tiles become like dark in reverse, like the colors are reversed, and it's absolutely beautiful. And we return to the Hell Dimension. And we get, yeah, we get some of the most the big quotes in this movie. Like, yeah, we get Pinhead and the Chatterer and Butterball. Butterball, interestingly enough, that's the big guy with the sunglasses. So he is played by Simon Bamford, who is another one of Clive Barker's friends from high school. And I feel okay sharing this because he shared this on Peaches Christ's podcast, Midnight Mass, when she interviewed him, which thank you, Peaches. You are one of the inspirations for this show. But yeah, he became part of this movie via a foursome he had with his partner, Clive Barker, and Clive Barker's partner at the So good.
Good for him.
Good for him. Good for him, honestly. He had a horrible time in that suit, though. I feel bad. Like, he had a line, but it
Oh.
got cut, and he was just not see or hear out of that thing. Oh, yeah. The makeups in this film are beautiful. I think it took about 4 to 6 hours to get everyone into their makeup.
Oh.
Yeah, so. Absolutely, troopers, really. Wow. That's so worth it. Yeah, so we get like some of the big quotes that this movie is known for. Like one of my favorite explorers in the further regions of experience, demons to some, angels to others, in my weak Doug Bradley impression, apologies. But I think that also that's such an important quote as we're defining the Cenobites, because they're not villains. They're not monsters. They're just doing their jobs. They're like neutral cosmic forces of sex. But the kind of sex that they do is not everyone's cup of goop, one might
Right.
say. So yeah, that's a really, really important thing about this first movie, and something that I think when you get into the later films, I think they tend to forget that while they're demons to others, they are angels to some. Like, yeah, this is someone's thing. So yeah, Cenobites, the word. Comes from it is from a Catholic tradition. It describes, there's nothing horny about it. It describes a person who would spend their life in a cell, or like as part of kind of religious asceticism. That's the word for that. And there is a cut scene wherein you see all of the Cenobites kind of pacing in their individual cells, like waiting to be summoned. But yeah. I think, yeah, to the costume and makeup designer, I think the only note that Clive had for her was that they would be magnificent super butches, which I love.
I love that.
I love that. Love it so much. Yeah. They, let's see. I'm gonna I'm just looking at my notes. I have lots of notes on this. The female Cenobite, which is her only name in the credits, which I kind of hate because they always have cool names. But she's just the female Cenobite. She was played by Clive Barker's cousin, Grace Kirby. Yeah. For the record, one thing to note that a lot of people complain about in this is that Pinhead, they're not pins in his head. They're more like nails. But in the book he is described to have like jeweled pins. And it's a slightly different character description. But we'll get to the book. We'll do a book episode on it. I'm very interested to hear your thoughts when we get to that. The name Pinhead, there's a couple of like myths about where it was sourced. Some folks think it was one of the makeup people. But Clive Barker historically, I think like he's kind of come to peace with it, but he really did not like that name. Yeah, he tried to rename the character several times, as like say the Hell Priest, or I think one of them was like the Cold One or something like that, which is a very good epithet. But yeah, when playing the character, Doug Bradley was constantly told to do less, quote unquote, by Barker. Like kind of let the makeup work on its own, because it really does. And so like, I mean, you can see that Doug Bradley's doing a very like subtle performance. He's like, his face is expressionless the whole time. And it's a very kind of monotone performance. That doesn't mean it's not good. I think it really works. But yeah, letting the makeup do the acting. I think his feelings on it was that he was attempting to create his sense of the perpetual mourning for his loss of humanity. And that's quoting from an interview with him. But I think that absolutely comes across. It's an amazing performance for how like little it's just doing so much. Yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I love the looks of these things. This is another thing that I could just talk about for hours, just the costume designs and the mutilation of the Cenobites on screen. They're amazing. Clive, in another interview on the Blu-ray that I got, which I would really recommend this Arrow Blu-ray. There's a lot of like really good kind of video essays and interviews on there that was just fantastic. Talking about Clive Barker's focused as like bodies as text. That is another thing that comes up a lot in his writing. Like the body and the destruction of the body as a work of art, which we touched on earlier as well. Another quote from an essay about the box itself, said the burlesque does not stop at clothes. We are also stripping
Ooh,
away.
I like that.
Yeah, it's a really good quote. Like we're stripping away skin. We're thinking about, like, you know, Freud's pleasure principle, that it is not super far away from like the sensation of pain to the sensation of pleasure. There's also, I mean, going back to Catholicism, there is a tradition in Catholicism of self-flagellation, of like self-punishment, as like a religious ritual. Yeah, he is the hell priest after all, as we forget. But yeah, there's something very, very special and very, very queer about body horror like this, about extreme body modification that looks freaky and painful, but like you can see how much like they walk with pride on like floor. That this is their choice. This is their art, that they are completely comfortable in their bodies and like sharing that with people, and that's beautiful, that's radical, and that's incredibly queer. Yeah, going back to a religion for again, well, I won't promise that'll be the last time, but there is a very strong kind of pressure in the various sects of sex with a C, of Christianity, that the body is unholy, the body is of the world and therefore ungodly, and that something will shed later. I think that body horror in general, with kind of a focus on the body, is very important, especially to like folks looking like me who grew up kind of being very feeling like I shouldn't engage with my body. But yeah, like just focusing on the body as a holy object, as a way to transcend, as a site of worship, as a site of art, is incredibly special. And that's again part of why this movie is so important to kind of the history of queerness and horror, and of body horror, and especially like erotic splatterpunk, which is a subgenre of the subgenre splatterpunk. I'll get as specific as I can with this because no one can stop me. Yeah, like we're weird and gross and so very sexy. Like I think there's a lot of kind of like degrossification of sex in movies these days. Like, yeah, I don't know. It's not as hot, quite frankly.
I don't really know how to fit this in, but I mentioned up at the
That's
top of the episode, I
what they said.
think. Hmm?
That's what they said.
That's what it is. I mentioned at the top of the episode that the Chatterer is one of my
Please tell
favorite
me about
horror
the
movie
Chatterer.
characters. I can't explain why I like him so much. That's the funny thing. It's the Cenobite who has no eyes, no nose, no hair, no ears, from what I remember, and no lips. He just has a mouth and he chatters.
Oh, he
And
chatters.
he is dressed head to toe in this cunty tight leather outfit, just like the rest of his friends. And I don't know why I like him so much. I like the simplicity of the design. I like the fact that he doesn't have to speak in order to be scary, and he also doesn't have to be violent. I think at one point he like holds Kirsty hostage or something like that, and I'm sure at some point he tries attacking, but for the most part he just comes off as a very intimidating figure. I don't know. I can't explain why I like him so much, but
Oh,
I just felt the
really
need to
good.
bring it up because
No, I'm glad you did.
I
Yeah.
feel like he's like the shining star of horror, and not a lot of people talk about him.
Yeah, no, we should. This is a justice for the chatterer. We
Justice for the Chatterer.
justice for the chatterer. We love him. Yeah, I think my favorite is probably either the engineer or the female Cenobite, which again, I hate that that's her name. She deserved a cooler name than that. But yeah, I love that kind of like headpiece, neck piece that she's
Neck
got,
piece,
that's like
yeah.
opening her neck like a little vagina slash wound of
Yeah.
Christ looking thing. Yeah, I love kind of the headdress, the circular thing she's got going on. It's very, yeah, it's very halo like. I really like that. But yeah, we're a big fan of Cenobites. I One of these days I will build my pinhead drag look and it will be beautiful. That's one of my goals in life. We've gotten past this bit. Curse he makes. Makes a Faustian deal with the Cenobites that they won't take her if they will take Frank. At this point, so she's escaped. Julia and Frank are freaking out. They're like, we're gonna get discovered. Okay, we have to up the plan. And so they skin Larry.
They sure do.
They sure do. And then Kirsty goes back to her house, and she's like, I want to talk to my dad. And then you get into the room with, Andrew Robinson, and you look at him and it's like, oh, there's something wrong here immediately.
Yeah. There's a very faint line of blood kind of around his hairline.
He's gooping at the seams.
Yeah.
I really love this moment because it's so tense. Because you don't know, they don't say that they're going to skin him. They very heavily imply what's going to happen, but we don't see it. By the time Kirsty goes into that room, we know exactly what's happened. And it's so tense and it's so disturbing because, Andrew Robinson really does have the range for this movie.
He does have the range,
He's amazing. It's a completely different character. I have so much respect for actors who play possessed characters or body swapping characters who can just become something different. Jeremy Irons in Dead Ringers, who plays twins. It's an amazing performance in that. I think that was a Cronenberg. We'll take a Cronenberg. Oh, we will. Very clearly, he's hugging his daughter and he's saying we killed Frank. It's fine now. And he's making eye contact with Julia over her shoulder, being like, what he did was unspeakable. And I'm like, oh, you nasty. Husting.
And then they show her dad's body.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
She doesn't know body. That it's her dad. It's just a red thing on the ground.
Another man.
Yeah. God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, they things go down. He says, come to daddy once more. And that was his big mistake.
That was his big mistake. He was too horny.
He was too horny for his niece. Disgusting. Yeah. Horrible. There's just so much disturbing, weird, incesty stuff in this. I don't enjoy it, but also I'm not mad it's there because it fits with the rest of kind of this very transgressive, nasty little film. That I appreciate that it's not shying away from the ick. I don't really have much to say about this little fight moment other than, Julia dies. Again, I think we get the ultimate betrayal here that, he really does not see her as anything more than a tool. He has his skin now, so he's not, it's nothing personal, babe. which is rough, which we'll get that line will come back the next, whenever we get to Hellraiser 2.
Oh, right,
But yeah, so she calls the Cenobites again. They return, and he identifies himself. They had to hear it from his own lips. And so, they take him here. And the chains whip out of the wall. He gets torn apart again. And this is a great moment as the chains are ripping apart his face. He's all stretched out and gross, and he's licking his lips.
Oh, right,
it's so nasty. And then his final line before he explodes, Jesus, what?
I want to hear your interpretation of that line.
So this line, it wasn't ad lib, I will say it. I think I don't remember what else he was going to say here, but it was something different. So the important thing about this line is that this is the shortest verse in the Bible. It is John 11:35 from the King James Version, and it is the shortest verse in the Bible at two words. It's from the story of Lazarus, which, if you're not familiar, Lazarus was a man who was dead, And his family went to Jesus to ask him to revive Lazarus and the resurrection. And so Jesus resurrects Lazarus. He brings him back from the dead. This is he's referencing a resurrection scene, and he's referencing Jesus. And I mean, even before you know the context, I feel like Jesus wept is such a gnarly thing to say in this scene. Like, it feels random,
yeah,
but somehow it fits. But yeah, knowing the context as well, like, I think this is the moment where he's saying, like, he's delivering one last blasphemy, but he's also saying, like, I came back before, I'll come again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. But yeah. And then, yeah, that, so, I mean, which I love the Cenobites, they go back on their deal.
Yeah.
They try to take Kirsty
as
well.
Those fuckers.
Yeah, those fuckers. Literally. yeah, and then we get the line, we have such sights to show you.
Yeah.
Line. And like, that's me sitting on my bed watching this film again, being like, he said the line. But yeah, it's good. I will say, like, at that moment where like Doug Bradley's pinhead like pops up behind Kirsty when she has the box. They literally had Doug Bradley like on a seesaw.
So no he would way! Probably...
This is the level of budget we have.
Oh my god!
So much.
Good for them.
Oh, that's so good.
I will say, I get why the final scene has to happen, where she has to send all of the individual Cenobites back by doing the puzzle box, mm-hmm. and the house catches on fire, and she runs away, mm-hmm. or whatever. I don't know. I understand why it happened and like how it wraps everything up, but for some reason it just kind of doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
It feels like it's taken
it's
from a
letdown.
Completely different movie.
Yeah, it's like you get like the epic the highs of the highs of with like the death of Frank and the climax of the family adventure, and then like, yeah, it does feel like we've gotten to this place and now we're just all standing in this room and we don't really know where we're going.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like it would have
cool
made
scene. It looks cool, but it doesn't like, yeah, from a plot standpoint, it just kind of bleh.
It would have made more sense, I think, if Pinhead and the Cenobites did not go back on their deal, mm-hmm. and they just took Frank away, and then for some reason the house just catches on fire.
Yeah.
I think
I
it makes more
that.
Sense that way. I feel like they were just trying to find more ways to include the Cenobites, which
yeah.
I understand, but mm-hmm. ultimately the
yeah,
final scene just
really
doesn't work for me.
Yeah, and then like, yeah, Kirsty's boyfriend shows up for some reason, which
yeah.
we all have forgotten at this point that he existed because he does nothing.
He does literally nothing. He's her
oh,
emotional
girl,
support animal.
Nothing.
I don't know.
Oh, bless. But one thing I noticed on this watch is that as they're like, banishing all the Cenobites, they don't actually banish Butterball. They just like bury him under some rubble. So like,
oh.
I'm kind of imagining him by the end of this movie like standing up in this house like, all right, you just live here now. He's just there. I mean, clearly
how
he
do
made
I
it
get back.
He can't I get back. yeah. But he's clearly back in hell for the second one. So he found his way back somewhere. But now I'm imagining I want that like I want that in-between movie of Butterball's adventures in the human world now. Simon Bamford, I know you can hear me. I know you're listening to this podcast.
Simon, get
Simon.
Out of here.
Anyway. So yeah, we've banished all the Cenobites. It's okay now. And then so we go to burn the box. And I think it's called the Derelict in the... credits shows up again, and as we've been teasing, becomes Bone Dragon. I remember the first time watching this and being like, oh, okay, you know, like this is the end of the movie, we're like watching a bonfire, and then like we had that one last thing, and I just remember sitting there like, yeah, all right, this might as well happen.
Yeah.
I love
kind of,
it.
Kirsty and her boyfriend's reaction as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, well.
You're like, yeah, this is.
Yeah, might as well happen.
This week's been weird enough already. Okay. Yeah, I honestly do like the ending. I like that it just flies away and it's literally never referenced again in all 11 movies after this one. I don't know. I like that. I think it does expand the world a bit. Like, we get a hint that there is something else going on and that this is a very small part of a larger universe. And then, yeah, we go back to the same table from the beginning, and we close with, "What's your pleasure, sir?"
Right, yeah.
Like the circle. So yeah,
And that's it. That's the whole thing.
that's it. Time to grade this thing on our completely objective grading criterion. So beginning with plot,
Yes.
I graded this about a 3 out of 5. So I think it's a very
I
good
agree.
plot. But there
Yeah.
are moments that it kind of lags, like we said, with the ending here. And so it's a good plot. It did not wow me enough to go past 3.
Yeah, it's passable. It's serviceable.
What did you put for that one?
3 as well.
Yeah, 3. Characters, I also said 3 out of 5 because, I mean,
Yeah.
Julia is my favorite out of this movie. But again, like, this isn't something that, like, I think to give like a 4 or a 5 out of 5 for characters, there would need to be more characters that grab me like she does. So it's
Yep.
good. Music is 5 out of 5. I love it. I love it so much.
For me, I would say it is also a 3.
Okay, fair enough. Did you what sorry, what did you put for characters?
A 3.
3. Yeah, tracks. Special effects and makeup, that's 5 out of 5, baby. This thing, it looks amazing. We've talked to death about the resurrection scene and the hell realm. It's just, it's very simply done, but it's very well done. It still looks amazing.
Yeah, 5 out of 5 for me as well.
Yeah, sets and costumes, it's 5 out of 5. The Cenobite costumes alone, but with like Julia's epic murder outfits, it's
Yeah, I love her
I have
outfits.
no notes. I have no notes.
For me, I love the costumes and I love the makeup, but the sets were a little bit lacking, so that's
That's
why I'm
fair.
giving it a 4.
Yeah, I'm giving it that much just because of like the Hell Dimension set is I love it very much. Yeah. Queerness, this gets a 4 out of 5. Now, the only reason this doesn't get a 5 out of 5 is because there's not a lot of explicit queerness. It's very much
Yeah.
kind of queer quoted throughout. That's not to say it's not super queer. This is a really, really, really queer film, as we've unpacked here, and it's got a lot of queerness behind the scenes as well. But yeah, yeah, I'm saving the 5 out of 5 for like the gayest of gay.
Yeah. I'm giving it
Which,
a 3 on the
yeah.
queerness scale.
Okay. Elaborate. Do you have thoughts? Why at 3?
Could be gayer.
I agree.
In
That's why
short,
I gave
I
it a 4.
think it has a lot of queer tropes. Obviously, the BDSM is associated with queerness, but for me, it doesn't have that feeling of queerness. I can't put my finger on why, it just isn't there.
No. I think Frank is important to that as well, because like he feels like a guy who has kind of dabbled a bit, but
He,
you know,
oh my
he's
God, yeah.
homophobic. He's very
He feels
homophobic
like,
to me.
yeah, he's like that kind of guy that you meet who like tried out being gay. He slept with a couple of guys in college and then he just like never went back to it. He just didn't, I don't know.
Yeah,
He's too
he felt
toxic.
like his masculinity was challenged or something by it or
Exactly. Yeah,
whatever.
yeah.
Yeah. I was weird about it. Anyway, spooks. So the scary moments in this movie. I also gave this one a 3. There's a lot of 3s in this one. It's because of like that scene with the rat peeling, and the final scene with Larry. There is a lot of incredibly chilling stuff in this movie, but it did not get me specifically, as I think a lot of films will.
I'm weirdly gonna give it a 4.
Oh, tell me.
Just because I feel like there are not a lot of older films that get me anxious or scared. And this one I remember genuinely had a couple of good, like minor jump scare moments
Does
and
yeah.
some scenes where I was very much on the edge of my seat. That does not usually happen with older
Okay.
horror movies. So I'm giving it a
Awesome.
4.
Awesome. Wonderful. Yeah, goofs. I don't know, 1 out of 5,
One
mostly
out
for
of five.
that.
That's what I was thinking. Yep.
Yeah, that hilarious cut between like she needs someone to talk to and murder boyfriend.
I feel like they try to make a couple of jokes that just do not land.
They
Like
don't really
there's
land,
that
yeah.
one scene at the beginning with the movers and Julia and Kirstie, and the movers are obviously like trying to flirt with both of them and they're failing.
Weird.
And it's like it's played off as something humorous, but to me it just comes off as very creepy and
Yeah.
not aging very well. And I feel like that happens with a lot of the jokes that they try.
Yeah. And I think like this movie's not trying to be funny, so that's not a knock against the film in any way. It's just this is not really an element of it. Okay, yeah, apologies. From this point on, we might get a little interference. Mac's laptop died, so we're in another room, but I think it should be fine. So yeah, moving on to the last criteria, we have the vibes points. I gave this
Vibes
4 out of 5
points.
because I love this movie very much. The vibes are amazing, from the music to the costumes to the themes. It's just great. It's not like make Stephen go feral insane. 5 out of 5. I love it very much. It's very special to me.
I'm giving
What about you?
it a solid 3 out of 5.
Wonderful. Yeah. Okay. So final score for me is 33 out of 45 points.
And my final score is 29 out of 45.
Okay. So we're going to average them. So that is 29 plus 33. Divided by 2. It is 31 out of 35, final score. This is respectable.
Very
It's
respectable.
respectable, very much. Okay, moving on to our Scream Queen. Are we ready to crown our Scream Queen for this film?
There's no God, buddy. And there's no heaven.
Come on, sister. How do you pray?
And do you know what pissed me off the most? No fucking wings!
I
For me,
doubt
there's
we even need to
no.
talk about
Do we even
it
need
because
to
I
talk
think we're
about
gonna
it?
say the same thing.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, and we'll say it at the same time.
Yeah.
One,
One,
two,
two,
three.
three. Julia.
Julia. It's
Yeah. It's a no-brainer. It's gotta be
oh,
her.
this is their evil stepmilf. She's everything to me. If she was skinned and asking me to murder for her, I would do it immediately, no question.
Which, no spoilers for the
No
second
spoilers.
movie, but
Yeah. We've talked
oh, we
about
have.
our feelings about Julia. Great. Moving on to the double feature.
I'm in movies too. Have you ever shown I Married Satan?
No.
How about the sequel? I Married Satan too.
So my pick for the double feature with Hellraiser is a little film called Scission. So it's from 2012, directed by Richard Bates Jr. It is about a teenage girl who has an erotic fixation on surgery. She wants to be a surgeon. The main reason I picked this is because it, like Hellraiser, balances these kind of erotic, like extreme splattery body horror sequences alongside family drama. Like in Hellraiser, the main kind of plot driving this movie forward is family drama, is the relationship between our main character and her mother and her sister. There's also a lot of kind of background Catholic stuff. Which is another connection we have between the films. And it's really gnarly. It's kind of darkly funny, but it's also incredibly emotionally devastating. Like, look up the trigger warnings on this one, guys. It's rough. But it's absolutely fantastic. I think John Waters cameos in it at
Oh
one
my
point. If you
God.
need more draws, it's yeah, he's a priest. It's so good. It's perfect. But yeah, I this movie needs more love. We'll definitely be covering it at some point. But yeah, that's my pick for the double feature.
I
What do you
have
have?
two picks that are tied. Can I
Yes.
go
Oh,
into
yeah, of
both of
course.
them?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. So my first one, by the way, both of these movies just so happen to be in my top five favorite horror movies of all time. My first pick is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I'm sure all of you have heard of. It is from 1974, It is, I would go so far as to say, an American Gothic film, just
Oh,
like
yes,
this
definitely.
one. It is very gory, I will say.
No, it's not, actually.
But it is.
All due respect, there's not a lot of gore in that film. It's all suggestion.
Well, that's true. Yeah. It's very anxiety inducing, I will say. It's very artsy. It's a lot more artsy than people give it credit for. And the reason why I'm recommending it is because it is another major horror movie franchise that if you haven't seen it, you probably think it's very different than what it actually is.
Oh, that's a
When
really
in
good
reality,
point. Yeah.
it's a lot more artsy. And it's, I don't know, it's a lot, highbrow isn't the word that I'm looking for. Pretentious
No.
isn't the word that I'm looking for.
It's
It's more
intentional.
intelligent than you think that it's going to be. It's not just a slasher.
It's very intentional with its commentary.
Yes, so I would recommend that. And my other recommendation is Candyman from 1992. I have not seen the new one, but I really should because I love this movie so much. Again, one of my top five horror movies of all time. It is another American Gothic one. It is based off of a short story by Clive Barker, who obviously created Hellraiser. It
Yep, The
is.
Forsaken, that's what it's called.
Oh, very
Yeah.
cool. Yeah, I have yet to read that as well. But it is just such a beautiful film. It is so haunting. The score is one of my absolute favorites of all time. Like, I
So
think the
good.
Candyman score is to me what the Hellraiser score is to you, Stephen.
I also love the Candyman's
Philip Glass, he didn't need to go
chorus.
that hard, but God damn it, he sure
Oh,
did.
he really did, yeah.
I love Phantom of the Opera, and so I love Candyman. I would it's not as big of a franchise as Hellraiser, certainly, but if you want to explore more modern takes on the Gothic, I would highly recommend Candyman.
Yeah, it's a really it's I love Candyman. We'll definitely get to that one at some point, but yeah, I think that one's also really interesting. It's like a folk horror film, kind of expanding the meaning of what that genre can be to like urban legends and the like. Yeah, okay. So I think that's about everything I have in my notes. I don't know, Mac, do you have any more closing thoughts?
Let me see. Let me consult my notes really quick. I think we got everything. That's all for me.
Right, fabulous. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank
I
you.
appreciate you very much, and I had so much fun talking about this movie. We'll be back to talk about the rest of them.
What are we watching next time?
So I think you'll be very excited as at our next movie, Mac, because you showed this one to me for the first time. We did a double feature this
Me?
one, and yes, you showed me a movie, and then I showed you
That
one.
does not usually happen.
If you remember, we double featured this one with Fear No Evil from 1981. Do you remember
Oh, yeah.
the
Oh,
gay
my
high
God. You're
school
so.
Antichrist movie? That one's on our list too, don't you fear. Anyway, our next episode we will be watching Frank Hennenlotter's classic 1990 film, Frankenhooker.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great one. I didn't know about this one before Mac showed it to me. I'd already been a Basket Case fan from his earlier trilogy. But
I still have not seen
Trent,
Basket
let's
Case. I know of Basket Case. I've seen bits of
oh,
Basket Case,
we'll watch
but I
Basket
only know
Case.
him
Basket
from
Case.
Frankenhooker.
Yeah, we'll watch Basket Case. We'll watch Brain Damage. We'll watch Bad Biology. We'll watch all of them. It'll be great.
But first,
But
Frankenhooker.
first, we will watch Frankenhooker. So get ready to be shocked out of your seat. Bring your brain drills, bring your super crack, and get ready for a sleazy, slimy little adventure on the streets of New York. Okay. So unless you had anything else to say about Frankenhooker or Hellraiser, Mac, I think we're ready to wrap up
I don't think
here.
so. I think we pretty much covered it.
Okay, fabulous. All right. Well, if you can take some time out of your busy schedule of having crazy adulterous sex with your new stepbrother. Not stepbrother, their brother-in-law. Or nailing rats to the wall, or, you know, whatever you're doing.
I'm doing that every day.
Tell your friends about the place where the monsters live and come on back to join us for the next one. We can't wait to see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And with that, we release you. But as you crawl on your hands and knees back into the world of light, remember, you're one of us now. You'll always be welcome in the place where the monsters live.
Hurry back. We'll be waiting.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM's podcast incubation program, Power and Voice. This initiative was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and we'd like to thank them for their support in bringing these voices to your headphones or earbuds or car speakers, however you are consuming today's episode. Thanks for listening, and thank you to the Community Radio Fund of Canada.